I'm talking today with Steve Lamb of Altadena, and we're at one of Altadena's favorite place for all of the thinkers in town to hang out, which is the Coffee Gallery up on North Lake. And Steve is a residential designer, which means he works on houses and improves them. And I interviewed Steve for the first section of my self-sufficient home book, which I'm sure all of you listeners already have, right? And Steve gave me a lot of good ideas about the ways in the past in which homes were built and designed to take advantage of the light and the wind and the heat so that we don't have to spend as much money as we do in the United States on heating and cooling. And thank you for taking your time to be with us, Steve.
You know, Christopher, it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, good. The pleasure is all mine, really. No, but I learned a lot from our discussions about the ways that homes should be designed. And you might, why don't you tell us about the gable house that we went over. What were some of the old designs that people built into the home to make it more efficient in terms of cooling and heating?
I think you're talking about the Gamble House.
Gamble House. What did I say? Gable.
Gable,
okay.
Yeah.
Gamble.
It's by Green and Green, who were two local architects here, and they actually graduated from college with degrees in what was then a fantastic new science. They were actually studying heating and ventilation in buildings, and that's what their certificates were in from MIT when they went to college, and that was a whole new thought that buildings would be well ventilated, that people would have fresh air inside of a building. And so what they did is they have very large overhanging eaves. They had no mechanical means in those days to keep a house cool, so they had to rely on every passive device they could come up with in Southern California to make the house cool.
Now, when did they build that house?
1906.
So are you saying that up until then there was no mechanical, there was no air conditioning of any sort?
There was no air conditioning really available to your average house until the end of World War II. There were systems that Frank Lloyd Wright developed that were used for commercial that basically refrigerated the walls. And there was a, Wright and Carrier also invented a water filtration cooling system early in the 20th century, but that was very expensive and it was only used for commercial buildings. And so for residential buildings, we really didn't have any kind of air conditioning hit the mass market until the end of World War II.
Okay, so what did they do at the Gamble House?
The Gamble House. The primary thing they did at the Gamble House was they have a large overhanging eaves. The eaves on that house, it's a two-story structure, and the eaves overhang about 7 feet. They have very, very large exterior porches that are also covered, so they're shaded areas. They have a large number of windows high in the wall. All the bedrooms and upstairs areas have windows very high in the wall so that you can open those and exhaust the hot air.
Okay, so the person living there has to take an active role in opening and closing the windows at the appropriate time.
Sure, yeah. And in fact, my house, I live in a house by another local Pasadena architect of that time period named Lewis Easton. And my house, people always comment on it in the winter that, or even in the summer, that it seems cool. It's designed to be cold because, again, they had no mechanical means to make the house cold. And if you open and close the windows throughout the summer and run mechanical fans, which is the only kind of cooling they had 100 years ago, you run your mechanical fans, you are actually comfortable in the house. There's maybe like 4 or 5 days in late August, early September where it's a little bit miserable. But the rest of the year, the house is comfortable.
Now, are the walls particularly thick or well insulated?
No, my walls are horribly insulated. Okay. My house is a board and batten house, which means it's a 1-inch board with 1x3 cleats nailed over that on
so if you're
side.
Angry, you can punch through it.
Well, one wouldn't want to do that. It really
right.
controls your temper. But, you know, the house is oriented to the sun.
Okay.
It's oriented to the breeze, the naturally occurring breeze coming off the mountains. And it has windows that allow you to cool it. I have It's hilarious. I don't have enough bills, actually, to, like, qualify for the solar electric lease back because my electrical bill is so low. People can't believe how low my gas bill is. The highest gas bill I ever have, I have one heater in the house that heats the bedroom, and I run a very small fan to circulate the air throughout the rest of the house. And my gas bill in the coldest winter is $35 a month. In fact, I just got my last gas bill.
That's very low.
It's very low, and I was outraged because my gas bill, you know, a couple of years ago was for December was only $28 a month, and so it's gone up $4.
I know people who are paying hundreds of dollars.
Well, but you know, they're not living like me. I mean, it's true in the not in the bedroom, which has the heater, but in the other rooms of my house. Generally in the winter, I dress like a European, which means when I'm at home, I wear a sweater.
Okay.
And I'm perfectly comfortable with that. But Americans have gotten out of that habit since we got central heating and air conditioning. And so instead of just wearing a sweater, they're paying hundreds of dollars a month for that privilege to not wear the sweater.
Now, I remember a few years ago in a heat wave here in Southern California, everybody had their air conditioners on. And there were brownouts and blackouts, and Edison was saying, please keep them off if you can.
Yes.
So you are living with the advantage of the person who designed your home, right? You're taking advantage. You had a good designer in the first place. Am I correct?
Lewis Easton was a great designer, and that house has been paying who's ever lived in it, whoever owns it, that house has been paying them for the last 106 years now. In terms of low...
And by virtue of no bills.
Low bills. And, you know, there are all sorts of methods for doing that. Unfortunately, one of the things that's happened in California now is Arnold Schwarzenegger sort of misguidedly appointed a bunch of heating, ventilation, and air conditioning engineers and a bunch of Edison employees to a committee to write a new energy code for California, and it requires that you have the mechanical systems in place and spend the money for them, even if you can design the building so that you don't need them. And that kind of has taken some of the incentive out because heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems are expensive. So now even if you're building the house so that you don't need them, you have to install them.
But, really? That's the luck.
Even if you can design the house so that it meets the specs, so that you don't have to have an air conditioning system, you have to now install an air conditioning system.
Wow. I know there's a small but growing movement to try to create homes that are more livable and self-sustaining and don't give you bills that cause you to take out a mortgage. But would you say that the root cause is the architects and designers in the first place?
No, you know, it's funny. Architects and designers for at least 100 years have been really radical on this issue. Frank Lloyd Wright, in 1938, designed a thing called the solar hemicycle, which was an earth-sheltered house that was actually designed to be heated in the winter in the middle of Wisconsin with the sun.
Did he build one?
He built it. Oh, he built several solar hemicycles over the years, but 1938 was the first one that he built for the Jacobs family, and that one has survived. It's still intact. No one developed it, and it literally heats and cools itself with the sun.
Really? Is it partly underground or something?
It's back wall.
Okay.
Where the prevailing wind comes down from the lakes, so it's cold in the winter. Its back wall is dug in. So there's a slight rise in the land. He dug it in. It's got a very thick stone wall. It's got a sod roof. It's got high windows just above where the house is dug in. And in the summertime, those windows open, and they open on the other end, and the air flows through and sucks all the hot air that arises from the ground out. And in the wintertime, those are closed. And the sun, because of the angle of how he placed the house, the sun literally heats the stone floor of the house and provides about 50% of its heating, and the rest of it's done with hot water floor heat.
So this was a designer who was ahead of his time, in a sense.
ahead of his time, and in many cases he was not allowed to implement those well-known historic technologies because they violated the local building and zoning code.
They did.
They still do, some of them, in some places.
Yeah. Well, I know how that works, like the building and safety in L.A. and all of that.
Oh, yeah.
So he had a unique situation, it sounds like. Let's say here in Southern California, I'm sure you can remember when Orange County and Cucamonga and all those places were wilderness. Now you've got urban sprawl. What's a person living in a place like that to do? The house has already been built. I'm sure there are probably modifications. In some cases, maybe the best thing is to find another place. Because it's, I mean, I lived in a place that had no, no air draft. Everything was terrible. But what are some simple modifications, maybe major modifications a person can do? Let's say they're stuck with what the state requires, the hardware. But are there methods that you can do? Because I know you've gone to houses and made modifications so people can have natural cooling or heating.
You want to get as much overhang on your south wall as you possibly can, your south and your west wall. That's where all your radiant heat comes from. In Southern California, you want the building to be cool. So you want to get some good 6, 7, 8 feet of depth in there so that you can shade the house so that in August, it's not just baking the house.
And you brought up a good point. On the south side, some houses, houses realistically are just built wherever they're built. But that would be the ideal, wouldn't it, that the house is facing the south?
Yeah. You know, in Southern California, it's a very strange thing because the houses are just, they've imposed this rectangular grid on the street pattern.
And all the houses face the street.
All the houses face the street. They just dump them down there. Whether or not that makes any sense for the wind pattern, whether or not that makes any sense for the solar pattern, they're just there. So you have to sort of try to take what you've been given and figure out how you're going to work with that. You don't really want a house on the south side of the street that faces north.
I've been in houses like that, and you know, they some of them are wonderful, and I noticed that, I'm thinking of one in particular in Altadena. It's always cold on the north side, and they seemed to have developed the south side as, you know, they realize that's where the sun is and that's where all the action is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, depending on how it's designed, that can either be very comfortable or that can be hideous.
Yeah.
And So that's a problem. I would try to, if you can, put more insulation in. Often one of the very best ways to insulate, particularly if you're already doing some remodeling, is spray in urethane foam. Now, it is a petrochemical, but, you know, you can get a tremendous amount of R value, that's resistance to change in temperature. You can get a tremendous amount of R value per inch with urethane foam. It's about 7 to 7.5 R per inch, which is almost better than anything out there that you can buy.
So in other words, rather than ripping out the wall, if you want to modify putting in fiberglass insulation, you punch a little hole and you blow it in.
No. You have to rip out
you
the
still
wall.
Have to rip out the wall.
Rip out
okay.
The wall. It's a real drag.
Okay.
You know, and one of the things is now with the new California Energy Code, when you do a small remodel, if it affects the energy usage of the house at all, in any way, you have to bring the entire house up to the new energy code. So that means basically you're going to lose, and because of the cost of that, you're also going to have to bring it up to the earthquake code, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it can turn a $35,000 bedroom addition into a $300,000 nightmare really, really quickly. But on the other hand, you know, you're going to get to bump up your insulation. And most houses, if they do have insulation that date from, say, the 30s or the 40s, they've got R11 insulation. With spray-in urethane foam with a 4-inch wall, you can get to 24. Well, that's going to help you a lot. And you're going to be spending money anyway. So that's really money well spent. When you get in this situation, you have to figure out, okay, it's going to cost me $5,000 to bring the house up to R13, which is what the minimum that they're making me bring it up to, or for an additional $1,100, do I bring it up to R24 and save a lot of money on my heating and cooling over the next 30 years? And that's really one of the things that's a problem with how we inhabit houses now. people only expect to be in a house for 3 or 4 years.
So they don't care.
They don't care. Yeah, they don't make the wise investments that are good for the long-term health of the planet and of themselves. And, you know, if everybody since 1973, when we had our last energy shock, was really looking at the house and saying, how do I drop my energy consumption from here on out? You know, we would have houses that were smaller, much more solar-oriented, much more oriented to natural wind, and that required far, far fewer inputs of energy.
So, I mean, it is nothing new, is the bottom line. All of this is old stuff.
Old stuff.
And I've long heard that probably the single one thing that you could do to dramatically lower your heating and cooling costs is more insulation.
More insulation.
Walls, ceiling, the floor, the whole thing.
If you're not on a slab floor, unfortunately. Now, slab building is kind of neat because it's cheap, but in the old days, they didn't used to put any insulation underneath that.
So that's where you lose a lot of heat.
You lose a lot of heat that way. Nowadays, when you have a slab floor, we try to put rigid insulation underneath it and radiant floor heat, which is nowadays it's a synthetic rubber tubing that goes all through that, and you can actually use that to heat your house. And with some systems, you can actually run cool water through it in the summer. It actually is like laying on a big rock, and when you've been hiking, you know, a big rock that's in the shade, and how that cools you down and refreshes you, it actually brings the temperature down in the whole house.
Oh, interesting. So there are a lot of innovative ways that people could do it. You know, I'm just thinking of something, the straw bale houses.
Yes.
That's a lot of thick insulation. What's the R value of a straw bale house generally? Once you've got, 2 feet thick or so?
2 feet thick, and you can get to like R38, R40, but there's problems with them in California.
It seems like if a rat gets in there, you've lost your wall, right?
The rats, it's hard for the rats to get in there.
It isn't? Okay.
Yeah. But you have to have a really huge footing for those. The footing is the cement and steel thing that is your foundation. And, you know, it has to be as wide as the wall and 3 feet deep, and so that's a problem. And then in California, they really don't consider straw bales to be structural. So you basically got to build a steel frame that supports the roof loads and becomes the wall load, and you basically use the straw bale as an infill.
I see.
And it becomes much more difficult to build it. It becomes much more expensive than it needs to be. You'd be better off doing a post and beam structure with stress skin panels, which are basically a piece of plywood on each side and sprayed in urethane foam, and you can get those 6 inches wide, so you've got an R30 wall. That's really, really nice. Lots of insulation, rat proof, fireproof, fantastic.
Yeah, I know there's. I know there's an organization that teaches how to make straw bale houses and other kind of alternative homes here in California, and I think it's cheaper to build your home that way, but they're not actually legal, are they? You need a variance to build one in, say, L.A. County?
They're under a very special experimental permit. I think these are also the guys who at one point did burned clay houses, and they also have a house form that I'm really, really interested in, which they take a burlap tube and they fill it with earth and concrete about 30%, and they lay it down with barbed wire that has really, really long spikes for their steel that ties it all together. Then they wet that down and plaster over it. And that actually is a very effective structure. But, you know, it's labor intensive. It's very hard for the building department to approve that because they haven't seen it. They're not used to it. You know, your engineer is going to...
And they almost can't see it when they go inspect, right?
They can't see it when they go inspect. Yeah. Plus, they can't comprehend it in their mind when it's sitting on the drawing.
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem we've had. There was a guy named Myron Hunt. He's a very famous Pasadena architect.
Myron Hunt, okay.
Myron Hunt, yeah. Myron Hunt invented what are called pneumatic buildings and roofs. Those are roofs that are made out of rubber, and you have a pump that pumps the shape up into a roof. He came up with a pneumatic skylight system that was two pieces of basically transparent or translucent rubber with a pattern printed on them. And this would rest on a steel frame, and so when you weren't pumping air through it, the patterns would rest on top of each other, and it would be a dark surface so that there was no light transmission coming in. And when you pumped it up with air, the farther the patterns would go from each other, the more light you would have inside. Well, they use the system all through Europe now, but it's not legal in the United States.
How would somebody find more about Hunt's system? Is there a book or a website about what he did?
No, there's really not. If you go on the internet and put in your browser pneumatic skylight, there are people in Europe who've done that. There's a house that was just done in Italy a couple years ago. Very large house for Italy, about 3,500 square feet. The entire roof is a pneumatic skylight.
Interesting.
And actually, the wild thing about this whole thing is, as you're pumping the air through in that space, it actually insulates.
The air itself.
In that space becomes an insulation.
Right.
And
so the reality is, there are a lot of alternative methods that are very likely better. Why are we still stuck with the old system? Is it simply because we're doing what we've always done?
Part of it's we're doing what we've always done. Part of it is the nature of the building approval and permit process, and the kinds of people who, after all, become bureaucrats.
Right.
Part of it is it's very difficult to get a bank to loan on something that's peculiar.
I see.
So if you're going to get a construction loan and they look at your documents and they've never seen that before, I mean, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright used to have a saying that there's nothing so timid as $1 million. And, you know, when you've got a bunch of bankers around and they're looking at that, they've never seen that before, that's really weird. You know, why do you
And they're just thinking
that?
They're going to lose their money.
They're thinking that you're not going to be able to resell it,
yeah,
or they're going to lose their money. And really, they've got a person who, if you've designed it to work with the earth, they've got a person whose house note is going to be almost their only bill. They're going to have extremely small energy input bills.
Mm-hmm.
Now with LED lighting, I'm excited about LED lighting. It's a technology that's evolving and improving and beginning to come down in cost. And I think in another 20 years, you'll have LED lighting that's even superior to incandescent.
Because it takes virtually no power, right?
And it takes almost no power.
Yeah.
So when they get it so that you can get, when they get the diffusers right, which is what they're working on now, you'll be able to get it so that you'll get foot candles to the floor. And we're going to have in the future fantastic LED lights. We'll be able to light with almost no wattage at all. You know, 20 watts will do 1,000-foot room easily.
So in some sense, technology will help us a little bit.
Well, you know, technology does help us a little bit. Technology always can help us. It's the misapplication of technology. Californians per square foot use less electrical energy than any people on Earth. The only problem is we didn't stick with our 1,200 square foot house. You know,
I say per square foot.
That's the important point. I mean, there are all these people who are living in 3,500 square foot houses. You know, and I go out all the time on consults with people, and they've got an 1,800 square foot house, and they're in their 50s. And they've either never had kids, or the kids are gone away to college and probably aren't moving back. And I'll go and they'll say, we want a 5,000 square foot house. And I'll go, what are you going to do in this 5,000 square foot house? And they really can't tell me. All they know is that Johnny and Sue down the street, who they go play bridge with, have a 5,000 square foot house. And
they're
in the same industry.
And therefore we should have one.
Therefore we should have one. And so you've got all these people living in these gigantic houses that really don't serve them functionally at all, that are no more pleasant, that are no more cheerful, that are no more filled with joy than they could have in a small 1,000 or 2,000 square foot house. But they've just bought the idea that they need big, and so they've got big, and they're using a lot more energy. They're paying a lot more money in terms of their mortgage than they really need to pay if they had a well-designed house.
So what you've identified is one of our energy problems is simply our choices. We're trying to outdo the Smiths or the Joneses or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the consumerist consumption. My value comes from how big and overly priced the stuff I own is, as opposed to who I am.
Now, I know when we talked before, I have a picture in my book here.
Mm-hmm.
somewhere of a room. I'm flipping through the pages here, but we here we go. We talked about how the size of the room allows you to use energy more efficiently, and like a small, maybe you could explain that. I was in a room one time, and it was the living room of a guy's house in San Marino, and literally my house will fit in the living room.
Oh yeah,
it was huge. So how, it's not going to be easy to heat that house, is it?
No, that's very expensive to heat and cool.
Because the ceiling was, had to have been 30 feet tall.
Oh, you know? I've worked in those for clients. Yeah. I used to do historic preservation. I've literally worked in closets that were as big as my whole house. I mean, I have a slightly less than 1,000 square foot house, and I've literally worked in walk-in closets that were 1,100 square feet. And
that's like Oprah's closet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't know. I've never been in Oprah's closet, but I can imagine. So when you have this gigantic volume of space, you've got a lot of air to heat and cool, and that air increases, you know, it's a cubic feet of air, and it increases geometrically as you go up arithmetically in the length of the room. So you've got, when you've got walls that are twice as long, you can have 300-500% more air that you've got to heat and cool.
And you have more usable space.
Well, you do have more usable space sometimes. Sometimes you don't. Also, if you make a room that's very, very high, for the footprint of that room, it's harder to change the temperature or keep the temperature even. So like if you've got a room that's, say, 16 feet wide by 25 feet long, and it's got an 8-foot ceiling, that's much easier to heat and cool than a 12-foot ceiling. And that's much easier to heat and cool than a 16 and a 24 and so on and so on.
And we're not talking just volume, but the fact that heat rises.
Heat rises. You actually, the higher the ceiling gets compared to the footprint, you can actually have inversions that make that difficult. I've been in some houses where the ceiling was so high and where they had such a differential that you would actually, at some conditions early in the morning when the light would shine in the windows, you could actually get mists. You would actually get fog.
You have weather inside the
weather
room.
Inside the house.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, what would a person do, let's say, aside from moving, would you put in a false ceiling? Would you put in a fan? What are some modifications if one wanted to reduce their energy usage? I suppose the average person listening to this show doesn't have a 30-foot ceiling.
No.
So that's not an issue.
Most people haven't done anything crazy like that. Of course, the first thing that you're going to want to do is insulation.
Insulation, okay.
You know, very, very often rooms that do have tall, high ceilings are what we call a cathedral ceiling. That's where your ceiling is going right up against your roof rafters. So I almost always, if that house does not have modern insulation, I will always try to get, again, a urethane, because that's the highest R value we can get per inch. I'll try to get urethane in there at about 5.5 inches so I can get about an R30 roof. That helps tremendously. You're going to want to shade the south if you can.
Like with trees and things?
Well, you know, deciduous trees are really, really good if we can pull that off, if our landscaping allows that, because that way when it's hot in the summertime, we've got shade, then in the wintertime when it's cold and we want some solar heat gain, the trees will drop their leaves.
Okay.
They'll warm up the house.
And then you mentioned the overhang also.
I like overhang. I'm a fan of that.
Well, I'm just thinking
in
about...
In Southern California. Now, there are places where, you know, in other climates in the country, you don't want overhang on your south house because you're trying to warm it. Here, we're trying to cool it.
Right,
In other places, you're trying to warm it.
I've been in Amish homes in Ohio, and their workshops, and they are built very differently, and they're not all cookie-cutter along the street, and there's large south windows and hardly no north windows. Because they don't use electricity at all, let alone cooling and heating. They don't use electricity, so the lighting has all got to be from that window.
Right. So they're getting their daylighting from there. They're getting solar heat in the winter because they live in, you know, Pennsylvania where it's cold.
Right.
They got snow. So they're getting solar heat gain.
And the ceilings are not really tall, and they're mostly heated by wood stoves.
Wood stoves, yes, and those aren't legal in California anymore to supply your heat.
Is that true?
Yeah, the AQMD has decided that the wood stoves can wood stoves and wooden fireplaces, wood-burning fireplaces, are no longer allowed to be legally installed. Now, you can burn a natural gas log, which is much less efficient, instead, because they claim that doesn't pollute as much. And this is sort of one of the issues I have with...
Natural gas log means a phony log and you're burning gas.
A piece of concrete, okay. you're right. Burning, you know, gas, yeah. A piece of concrete designed to look like wood. One of the real problems I have with some of the energy codes and some of the environmental codes is that, oddly enough, they make you use more petroleum, and they get rid of your ability to be self-sufficient.
Now, that's not an accident, right?
I don't believe it's an accident. I mean, I'm sure that, and I've been to some of the meetings, and I've even pointed this out, or the public hearings, and they insist that's not their intention, and it's just kind of an unfortunate accident if it occurs. But I really have a hard time believing that, you know, it just so happens that every time they pass a supposedly environmentally friendly ordinance, your petroleum use goes up. That's kind of odd.
Now, I've burned wood for years, and I think I did hear about that law, but that doesn't apply to pre-existing wood stoves and fireplaces. Am I correct on that point?
Sort of. Your pre-existing unit is still legal, but you have to, before you burn it, call the AQMD every day.
Oh, you're kidding. You've got to call them every day?
You've got to call and ask them, is this a burn day or a no-burn day?
I see smoke all over the place when I drive around town in the cold days.
I hear nothing.
Well, that's what me too. You know, I was recently in Guatemala, and just in terms of a contrast in culture, you see fires all the time.
Sure.
I mean, I'm sure the air standards are not like the United States, but when people are burning off a field, they burn it.
Yeah.
You know, there's wood stoves. It's a whole different thing.
Well, you know, wood heat is very, very different from natural gas heat. My good friend John Laraway, when he lived in Altadena, he had a wood stove, and I was amazed the first time I visited him in his house, because I came in, it was from his house, it was outside, it was January, very cold that year. I walked into his house and it was almost unbearably hot. And he actually had not, he lit a small fire when he got up in the morning at 6:30 and another one at about 5 in the evening. And that kept his house roasty and toasty literally all day long.
Yeah, yeah. But the home was insulated, probably.
No, John had a 1913 house. His insulation was horrible. In fact, his house was all designed all wrong for all the things we always talk about that you want to do for passive. But, you know, he had a mass of bricks that his wood stove was near, and he had the wood stove, which was iron. And he warmed that mass up, and it kept his house very, very warm for hours. In fact, sometimes even in the winter, it would be so hot that they would have to open the windows to cool the house
down. Now, was he burning, like, any special wood? Because I know different woods have different BTU contents.
Right.
Like, oak is better, yuca is pretty good.
Well, actually, very interesting you should mention that. He burned what used to be a very traditional California mixture of wood, which would be pine, eucalyptus, and oak.
So that sounds good. I tried to avoid pine because it sparked, and it actually burned up too quick. But you can get it for free on trash day.
You can get it for free on trash day. It's excellent kindling to get your eucalyptus and your oak started, because they resist starting.
Yeah.
So it gets you a lot of fast fire to get your hardwood started.
Yeah.
And the hardwood burns hot enough that it burns out the creosote that the pine's trying to deposit in your flue.
Yeah, you know, my house wasn't that insulated. We started doing it, and I don't live there anymore, but we started doing it little by little in Highland Park. And when we got the wood stove, it totally transformed the experience of living there. It was warm, like you say. Mm-hmm. And for people who don't experience this, in Los Angeles County, maybe in every urban place, on trash day, people prune the branches and the wood in the yard. They bundle it for the trash, and it fits into the wood stove. I would drive by, pick it up, make sure it was aged, and take it home. I never bought firewood.
Awful sweet of them to do that for you.
It was like, I can't believe it. This is how wealthy we are.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
we throw away everything. And it's so, again, I'm getting the same theme that we are our own enemy.
Right.
We've got all the solutions. When we were talking about a big room, we're talking about the heat rises, in a large room, is heating the biggest problem, or is cooling an issue too? It seems like cooling wouldn't be as big of a problem.
You know, it's interesting you mention that. All of those large houses I've ever been in are always cool, even the ones that date from the 20s that don't have
air. That's my experience too. Yeah. They always seem cold, like an old castle or something.
Yeah, cold.
So they're good
mildewy.
In the summertime. Yeah.
Well, they are good in the summertime.
Yeah.
But very cold and very hard to heat in the winter.
Yeah.
But you know, you were talking about the wood thing again. My wife's family is from the Netherlands, and we go back there occasionally. And last time I was there, I was helping one of her uncles cut up some stuff in the garden, and it was, you know, twigs and pieces of wood, maybe to about 2.5-3 inch diameter. And I started throwing it in the trash.
Yeah.
And he comes out and he's like stopping me. What are you doing? What are you doing? You know. And well, he forgets for a moment that I'm not Dutch, so he's
you're a
yelling
Yankee.
At me. Yeah, he's yelling at me in Dutch, which I don't understand. He finally realized and translated. And they don't throw that away. They don't throw any of that away. They keep all that. They burn all that. And, you know, they're a wealthy, industrialized country, but there's no way that they're going to let even their yard cuttings go into the landfill. They're going to burn that and use it for BTU.
Now, are they using it to heat the house or also to cook with?
They do not use wood to cook with, but they still use it to heat the house. The Dutch have had a natural gas for a couple hundred years. In fact, it was a Dutchman who invented the process to take coal and apply various chemicals to it to form what used to be called illuminating gas.
Okay.
And so they've had that for about 300 years.
Uh-huh. I know that in some of the travels I've done, I've seen some very ingenious twig and wood stoves. I know most people go to charcoal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it drives home this idea that we have so much, but we don't even know how to use it or that it's useful. I've seen little, even small stoves, and I couldn't believe how well they heated. In fact, it was a Pasadena guy
mm-hmm.
who invented a little stove. It folds flat. It's called the Pyramid.
Okay.
Now, I think that he sold it because it's remanufactured, and it's not called the Pyramid anymore, but it looks like a pyramid shape. And basically, you could put charcoal in there,
mm-hmm.
or twigs, and I've always just put twigs in there.
Okay.
And you could put one or two pots on the top, and it heats well.
Now,
I'm sure that, again, that would probably violate certain standards, air standards.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you're violating about 30 laws just thinking about that. Yeah.
But I've heard an interesting statistic once that some plastics, not all, some plastics burn cleaner than wood, depending on what wood we're talking about. That there's a hard plastic that Trader Joe's has their like carrot juice in. That hard opaque plastic will actually burn really clean. Whereas I mean, it's just an interesting thing. We always think plastic is bad, wood is good. But pines, for example, it's a hydrocarbon that it emits, and so basically it does pollute. But my thought was always that it's raining, it's winter. Isn't the air going to? I mean, are we really talking about a permanent form of pollution in this case?
Probably not. You know, water is actually one of the best air filters there is in the world. All the really high-quality industrial air filters for factories actually use water as the cleaning agent. So burning on a rainy day should be excellent.
Yeah. Now, that brought up another idea I had. We put a little, they called it a catalytic converter, in the line of our wood stove.
Yes.
And it seemed that the fumes... It slowed down the fumes a little bit until you got an airflow,
mm-hmm.
but it seemed like the house got a lot warmer. And there are various devices you can get that go in the flues. So we have all, even with low-tech things, there are high-tech ways to improve it.
There are people who use draw fans to increase the heat.
What's that mean? What's a draw fan?
Well, it's a fan that's in line in the flue. And the turbulence from the fan increases the draw.
In the fireplace.
In the fireplace.
Okay,
now,
okay.
A lot of the ones that they sell now are electrical, but I have this catalog that a friend of mine gave me here at the coffee gallery because he knew I collected weird old things on weird technology. And it was a 1930s auction catalog of 16th and 17th century household furnishings. And the amazing thing is, you know, they have like barbecue spits in there for the fireplace and stuff, but in there they had a whole section on these little fans that people would install in their fireplace flue, and they were just on a bearing and they had a fan, and the purpose of these things was as the heat would rise, it would cause the fan to turn, and as the fan turned, this caused the fireplace to draw more air.
From
the turbulence.
Okay.
The heat rising and the fan turning, so it actually increased the heat of the burn in the fireplace.
Interesting.
And, I mean, they knew about this.
What was the era of this product?
This is, you know, the colonial era in America.
Really?
1700s. So they knew about this basic technology 200-300 years ago.
Interesting. So, you know, we only have less than 10 more minutes, but... And I think we could, I would love to do a show where we talk about devices. You know, I've been to cabins up in these mountains where people designed it, they were smart the way they designed it. But in terms of the average home, what about painting the roof white? You've heard of that?
I don't personally like it. I think it's ugly.
I don't like it either. I don't like the look of it,
yeah.
But it seems to be very effective.
It is effective. There are new roofs now. If you're at the point where you need to redo your roof, I'm going to say I like GAF Timberline. It's a high quality 30-year asphalt based roof. But what they've done now is their roof that used to be sort of a more blackish color, they've put a lot of gray granules, a lot of white granules kind of in there for the shading effect, and they've actually improved that roof's performance, its energy performance, by 30%.
Really?
Yeah.
I have found, and I did this at a few locations, I just wanted to get your take on it, but there's this white stuff by Henry's.
Oh, yes.
And it's designed usually for people in motorhomes or trailers,
yep,
where it's a metal roof. But I put it on my roof because it also seals leaks, and I couldn't afford a new roof.
Yeah.
But the temperature in the summer was lower by at least 15 degrees.
I can believe that.
Yeah.
That's and we've got in the code now, we've got what are called white roof requirements. And basically the old, like all solid black roofs, they don't even sell those in California. You can't get that kind of shingle anymore. They have to be specially modified for California,
mm-hmm,
so that they have more of a reflective content. And that's a good thing. And another roof that, if you're thinking about doing it, you can actually do a standing seam metal roof. And I'll
describe that so I know what you mean.
It looks like a standing seam metal roof. It's like a flat, low pan that's bent up at 90 degrees on each side, and they put those pans next to each other on special holders, and then the standing seam is this piece that clips on over that. A lot of restaurants have them.
And this it insulates better or makes
it reflects.
Oh, it reflects better. Okay,
better.
So the place will be a little cooler.
The place will be cooler. And while it's made out of metal, this is a roof that can last 100 years.
I see. Yeah.
And it is a little bit more expensive than a high quality shingle roof. It's about 20% more expensive, but it lasts.
Right.
100 years instead of 30 years.
Yeah, if we could think long term, we go a long way to solving our problems.
Long way.
What do you think about double pane windows, special seals on windows, attic fans, run them from the sun, devices like that?
Oh, you know, I am so excited. I just got a new catalog the other day, and they actually have solar attic fans. I mean, I'm like, that's so neat.
Right, right.
I mean, in fact, the funny thing is I'm probably going to order one this week.
What was the price range in general?
You know, the price range for those, I've seen several different kinds. It kind of depends on the size of the solar panel and the size of the fan. But they run anywhere from about $60 to $230.
Okay, you know, I saw one. I don't know if the manufacturers or just the sales rep, they're over here in La Cunada, not far from us. They were running about $400. And I understand that Costco or Home Depot here in Southern California also sells one, and it looks like even a guy like me could install one.
You know, they're amazingly simple. They're really beautiful. I mean, you need a screwdriver.
And a saw, I guess.
Well, you don't really need a saw to install one.
Well, let's see. Don't you have to have a hole into the attic to suck the air out?
You can actually install it in your gable vents if you have
a gable.
You can just install it in the end where there are those
ventilating
spaces.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, so that's a good idea. And what about, I know double pane glass serves as insulation.
Double pane
glass.
It's
pricey, though.
It's very pricey. Actually, you can get, if you've got a house and you're trying to make improvements for a low cost, there are films that you can get, Some of them are reflective, some of them are not, and you know, some people don't like the silver look.
I think it's a 3M, 3M makes them.
3M makes them. But some of these films, like the light bronze tint film, gets your window almost to the same level of performance as a dual pane window.
Really? Really? Are these available, like, I haven't searched these out, at Home Depot or anywhere?
I don't know. You know, the guy who I have do it in Altadena is a guy named Dave DeBow. And Dave does this for friends of mine and clients who don't want to go spend $6,000 on brand new windows and throw their old windows into the landfill. And he can do this, and it makes a noticeable difference in people's heating and cooling.
We're basically talking a film that sticks onto the glass.
You know, sort of like people did in the 70s with their lowriders with reflective stuff to annoy the cops, except this actually doesn't have to be reflective, but it is a film that goes on the glass. It keeps the glass cleaner, actually. Keeps the glass from getting condensation on it. And it also has a very, very nice side benefit of cutting your energy.
Now, this is separate but unrelated, but I've seen apartment buildings that face the sun, the windows face the sun, and there's almost nothing they can do. And I've seen they put up tinfoil in the window, but I've heard that that's bad for the glass somehow. It makes it more brittle. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
If the glass is laminated, yes, it will make it more brittle.
Uh-huh.
The other thing about that is, and it's why, like I mentioned, that some of these are not reflective on these films. If you have a highly reflective surface, you're going to reduce your energy consumption, but you're going to increase your neighbor's energy consumption. Do you know where Bob's Big Boy is out in Burbank or Toluca Lake?
Isn't that one of the originals?
Yeah, it's one of the originals.
Yeah, I know where you're talking.
Okay. There's a... you go to that Bob's Big Boy, and then on the corner from that as you go east, there's a little pharmacy building, and right next to that there's a building that was built in the 70s. It's an office building, and it's got all this reflective glass on it, and literally in the afternoon when the sun is setting, you can see that this glass is reflecting all this light onto this pharmacy building, and it's just blazing this building with heat.
They're in the middle of the solar heater.
So yeah. The office building's energy consumption is lower, but the pharmacy building across the street has just jumped through the roof with all the solar heat.
I see. So if that pharmacy building wasn't there, it would be okay. But in other words,
if it was in another location, it would have probably 30% less air conditioning load than it has.
I see. Interesting. Well, look, we're just about out of time, Steve. Do you have any books or references that you might want to suggest to people? I know you mentioned some old book about buildings once when we talked before.
Oh, goodness, I can't remember the title.
Something that was in the old Whole Earth catalog.
Yeah, it was actually by 10 Speed Press.
That's right.
And
The House or something like that?
Well, there is The Natural House. That's a good book. It's not by 10 Speed Press. But it was...
It's probably in my book, The Self-Sufficient Home.
I think it probably is.
Which you all should buy. That's my shameless plug. Self-Sufficient Home is on my website.
No, I know that you did mention it in there. I just can't remember.
It's in there somewhere.
But it was printed originally in the 70s. It's been reprinted, but it has hundreds of ideas that are well proven throughout hundreds of years of human history on ways that you can be more energy self-sufficient in your house.
I'll try to find that name and put it on our show notes. And we're out of time, and I want to thank you, Steve, for being with us today.
Thank you, Christopher. It was a pleasure.